From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America presents Issues in the News. The nation's top Washington correspondents offer their perspectives on the week's major stories. Your moderator is Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Issues in the News begins now. Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me on the show today are Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to National Journal, and Abdurrahim Fukara, Washington Bureau Chief of Al Jazeera Satellite TV. And here are the issues. Israeli troops and Lebanese Hezbollah militia clashed with artillery barrages, prompting what the Washington Post called new war fears in the Middle East. In Washington, Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu's acceptance of a Republican invitation to address Congress in March sparked a furor that included an angry reaction at the White House. In Ukraine, rebels backed by Russia continued to make gains, including capture of the Donetsk airport. Meanwhile, President Obama traveled to India and then to Saudi Arabia after the death of King Abdullah. And in Washington, the Obama administration and the U.S. Army argued over whether Sergeant Bo Bergdahl, swapped for five imprisoned Taliban militants last year, should be prosecuted for desertion. Well, Tom, I'm going to start with this last issue, the whole question of Bo Bergdahl, who this was in May, I believe, of last year. And it was such a big deal when he was freed by the Taliban and the five Taliban prisoners were released. His family, his parents were brought to the White House and introduced and hugged by the president and so on. And now the question of whether he's going to be prosecuted for desertion. You see, the Army wants to, and the White House is not so sure.
Well, that's exactly right. This is a potential big embarrassment for President Obama because, as you said, when Bergdahl was released, President Obama brought his parents to the Rose Garden of the White House and made a big deal about it, about we never leave our men and women on the battlefield if we can help it. I think the central fact here is beyond dispute, which is in 2009, then Specialist Bergdahl left his army post and was grabbed and ended up in the hands of the Taliban. That much is clear. Why he did it, the motivation, there's lots of different explanations for that. But under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, it would be pretty easy to make a case that he left his post. Now, desertion is a bigger deal. Theoretically, you can be executed for desertion, and some U.S. soldiers were executed during World War II for desertion. But it's very clear the Army believes that Bergdahl should be prosecuted for something. I do know for a certainty that the Army was ready to act on whatever they were going to do last fall, and the White House intervened. The White House did not want this issue resolved before the election. But I have to say, a highly respected reporter for NBC News broke this story that the Army was going to recommend that he be charged with desertion. And I also know the White House went kind of crazy about that, and there's a lot of pressure on that. I suspect at the end of the day there'll be some kind of a middle ground if one can be found. Maybe you begin a process. The Army has a...
We could be charged with a lesser crime, if that's what it is.
If I had to bet, I would bet that Bergdahl would be charged and prosecuted for leaving his post, which is technically different than desertion.
Yeah. It's sort of the difference between a felony and a misdemeanor,
right,
and lesser offense.
I suspect that whatever happens, Sergeant Bergdahl will not be on active duty a year from now. I mean, you have, there are all sorts of formulations. Leaving your post, discharge under less than honorable conditions, all sorts of things short of desertion. It's become complicated also because one of the Taliban terrorists the U.S. government exchanged for Bergdahl has reportedly now back in the fight, reengaging in terrorist activity, according to the chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, a Republican. And so that's not helpful to the Obama administration. So this is a mess. But, you know, the Army and the military and the Pentagon all understand that basically there is a certain ethic in the military, and among the essence of those of the ethic is that you never leave your dead comrades on the battlefield if you can help it. And military order and discipline is paramount. And the whole notion of a soldier walking off his post and not being punished in some fashion would be anathema to the military chain of command. I think this is yet another small example of all the frictions between this White House and this Pentagon, some of which led, I believe, to the forced departure of former Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel in the last few days.
Tom, very good. Now we're going to turn to the issue of the Israelis and Hezbollah. And we're joined now by Abdurrahim Fukara, the Washington Bureau Chief of Al Jazeera Satellite TV. Abdi, here's my question. You know, I quoted that The Washington Post, but it says new war fears in the Middle East. Should we fear another war building up here between Israel and Hezbollah?
Well, I think, as we all know, there are already several wars happening in the Middle East, even in places such as Egypt. People may not be calling it war, but it is war with all the attacks on the military that we have seen recently. But the issue of Israel, of course, there's always that possibility that, you know, the spark is there. There are actually many different sparks. I think, on the other hand, looked at strategically, it seems that neither the Israelis nor Hezbollah nor Iran see an interest for themselves in having all-out war at this particular point in time. The Iranians, for example, for all the bluster that we've heard from Tehran after the killing of their general in the Golan Heights by the Israelis, I don't think at this particular point in time they want to risk derailing the talks with the Obama administration over their nuclear issue. Hezbollah, although it's playing a prominent role in Syria, but internally in Lebanon, I'm not sure how strong it would feel inside Lebanon waging war against Israel. Israel, apart from electoral calculations for Benjamin Netanyahu, it's hard to predict to what extent he would see war with Hezbollah as serving his election purposes. But the Israelis also seem to be feeling very sketchy and very queasy about all-out war with Hezbollah or with the trio, Hezbollah, Bashar al-Assad, and Iran at this particular point in time.
Well, that certainly makes sense to me, Tom. You can add to that.
Just a little bit. It just seems to me that both sides at the moment are looking for reasons not to escalate as opposed to looking for reasons to escalate. It's really not in anybody's interest at the moment.
It is in the media's interest.
Well, that's true, but I'm trying
to... The Post was sort of fanning the flames.
That's right, that's right. But Iran is involved in these delicate negotiations with the United States. Prime Minister Netanyahu is coming to Washington to address Congress, much to the irritation of the Obama administration. There's lots of reasons why both sides don't want this to develop into an all-out war. I mean, nobody wins on that one, except, as you suggest, perhaps the media. So I think this is serious when you have a loss of life on both sides of the border, but I don't think there's a stomach of any of the combatants to make this a bigger deal.
Well, I was being a little facetious about the media, but I do want to turn. You mentioned Benjamin Netanyahu. I think probably the biggest argument in Washington at the moment, and there are plenty over the overspending and the budget and so on. There are a lot of them, but a big one is this Republican invitation to Bibi Netanyahu to come to Washington to speak to Congress, something that was not cleared with the White House. The White House will not see him when he comes, if indeed he does come. And one of the arguments against it is that, look, the job of the Israeli prime minister is to get along with the president of the United States, because the U.S. is the biggest defender and supporter of the state of Israel. On the other hand, Republicans are certainly allowed to invite him. They control Congress. Abdi, what's your take on this?
Well, obviously, as you know, here within the United States, there are Americans who do support, you know, the call by John Boehner to Benjamin Netanyahu to come and address a joint session of Congress. There are, however, many other Americans find it very strange, and they find it very strange also from the point of view of American sovereignty that Boehner is actually opening the gate for Israeli politics to bleed into United States politics. Looked at from outside the United States, it looks even more strange to people that this kind of thing could happen in American democracy, that the president of the United States was not involved in extending an invitation to the head of a foreign government to come and address a joint session of Congress. But, you know, that's where we are now. It seems to me that initially, when the call was first made. This is my reading of it. It looked somehow creative and imaginative on the part of John Boehner to tell Obama, okay, you want to come and address us in Congress during the State of the Union speech, being so upbeat, although we control both houses of Congress, fine, let me throw you this one and see how you handle it. But all the debate that has happened since, and all the contortions of the White House to actually deal with it. It seems to me that the take now may be getting a little different on what John Boehner did, in the sense that this may backfire for John Boehner, may backfire for Benjamin Netanyahu. Yeah. And I think that the White House is already trying very hard to find a way out for the White House, but also for Benjamin Netanyahu to back out of it.
Well, he raises a good question, Tom, and that is whether this speech will actually occur. And correctly, I think there has been a sort of a shift in from saying, gee, this is really something interesting that John Boehner's doing, to, boy, this is really risky for Benjamin Netanyahu. He doesn't get along with President Obama, but this will not improve that relationship for sure. And it's critical for any prime minister of Israel.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. You've got to, as a prime minister of Israel, you have to maintain at least reasonably cordial relations with the United States. I do think the U.S. support for Israel is essentially unshakable. Many presidents from both political parties have certified that. But what I think it really shows you is the mutual disdain there is, not just between Obama and Netanyahu, for whom a White House official said to me several years ago that Netanyahu and Obama share a minimal high regard for one another. But it also shows you the real disdain, I think, verging on contempt between President Obama and Speaker Boehner. They don't like each other. They don't get along. They have zero relationship, even though they say they have a cordial relationship. They don't like each other. Boehner's not going to do anything to help Obama, and vice versa. And I think this was a real, I think the Boehner ploy, I think he was totally within his rights and prerogatives to do it.
Yeah.
This notion that it's unconstitutional for him to do that is ridiculous.
Of course.
But, I mean, it's the optics, not the constitutionality or the propriety of it. And I think the tip-off here was not just that the White House didn't clear it, because you knew a Republican Speaker of the House was not going to clear something like this with the White House, but the White House was not even notified in advance. Yeah. And as a matter of fact, there's a story running around that has been confirmed that Israeli ambassador to the United States had spent a couple of hours with Secretary of State John Kerry the day before this was announced and didn't even raise it.
Really?
So that's malice aforethought. So it really is a mess. And it's interesting. I mean, let's put it this way. If the speech doesn't happen, it will be because Prime Minister Netanyahu decided it was not useful for him after all.
Yeah, indeed. All right. We'll have more in just a minute. But first, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me today are Abdurrahim Fukara of Al Jazeera and Tom DeFrank of National Journal. And this is a reminder, you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. The program is also available for a free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on your website at voanews.com/issuesinthenews. Well, we're going to turn to the Russians and the rebels, so-called, in Ukraine. And, you know, the U.S. seems to be out of the picture for now, for dealing with the Ukraine. The president has made, I think, a lasting decision that we're not going to arm the Ukrainian army. And the rebels supported by Russians and so-called volunteers that have gone in from the Russian army seem to be gaining. And it looks like ultimately they will get enough of the eastern Ukraine, if not stopped, so they will hook up with Crimea, which has already been annexed by the Russians. What do you make of it, Abdi?
Well, I mean, quite frankly, I'm having a bit of a problem reading the Obama administration's position on this. Mm-hmm. What exactly is the ultimate plan for him? Everything that we've heard over the weeks and months is that he wants diplomacy to actually take the prime position in trying to resolve this issue. When I say diplomacy, I mean also sanctions. We know that the Europeans have been talking about sanctions. They've talked a few recently about sanctions. They talked about extending existing sanctions. They didn't talk about slapping new sanctions on Russia. But it seems to me that Putin, at least temporarily, is in a stronger position now that, you know, the rebels have reportedly taken the towns, the one town or two towns that have been in the news. And with the divisions within Europe, especially after elections in Greece that have brought a leftist prime minister, the calculation in Moscow was that this may, one, it'll keep the Europeans busy talking about the euro and the eurozone, and two, the fact that they have a leftist prime minister, it may take the European position slightly differently in favor of Russia. This may be a miscalculation, having said that, on the part of Putin, because the Greeks, the primary issue for them is sorting out their economic mess within the eurozone or outside the eurozone, as some of them want to say.
What about the economic mess in Russia, where I think it was assumed by a lot of Europeans and Americans that with the oil price cratering, and it's so important to the Russian economy and the Russian funding the Russian government and so on. How can Putin and Putin seems to be unaffected by that?
Well, that's where the Obama administration may think that its policy is coming in handy. First of all, it's already been arguing that the sanctions have produced an effect, basically pushing the Russian economy where it is today. And then, you know, all this talk about some deliberate plan between the Obama administration and the Saudi government to keep pumping oil in a way that would keep reducing oil prices so that some of Washington's adversaries, whether it's Moscow or Caracas, Venezuela or others, are actually brought to the position, in the case of Russia, to the negotiating position where the Obama administration wants them. This is all political hyperbole at this this point in time. But the Obama administration clearly seems to see value in that.
Tom, I really expected, you may have too, that the drop in the oil price, which has been incredible, and Russia being so dependent on it, would have changed things. It really hasn't. And Walter Russell Mead, who writes about foreign policy, wrote, "Oil price crash aside, Putin reasons things are breaking his way." And well, Abdi seems to suggest that. I would agree with that.
President Putin seems to have adopted the old strategy of the best defense is a good offense. Yeah. I mean, what, we have an oil problem? No, no problem at all here. I mean, they, as you say, their economy is now a basket case. Putin gambled that oil and gas would be nirvana for for his economy, and it hasn't. And he's had to dip heavily into his financial reserves. But yet, I think on the ground in Ukraine, I think you're right. I think the situation has improved for Putin. It's pretty clear that NATO has a problem and the economic union has a problem with the new Greek government, mainly because both the EU and NATO operate on a rough consensus. Basically, everybody's got to be all in for something or it doesn't happen.
And yeah, with Russia, it's a consensus of one.
Right, exactly right. So it's I think at the moment, Putin has gained some territory, both geopolitically and geographically.
Well, I think that's right. And whether it'll continue or not, well, we will see. The oil price has to have had some impact on this adventurism of Putin sometime. Well, anyway, look, let's turn to President Obama's travels. He went to India. Was that his first trip to India, Tom?
No, it was his second trip.
That's what
he's been. But it was supposed to be the first trip to India where he was going to visit the Taj Mahal, but he had to cancel that part of it. He spent a lot of time. He likes Prime Minister Modi. They seem to be developed a rapport, and this was important. The White House leaped at this because President Obama was invited to be the guest of honor at Republic Day, which is the biggest single day in the in the Indian political and social calendar. It's the day that commemorates India's constitution being made permanent, and there are parades, and there are a lot of flashy displays, Bengal Lancer uniforms from the old.
I love that stuff.
Well, the Indian culture loves that stuff too, and it was, and of course you had the Russian tanks and the Russian helicopters and the Russian airplanes, but it was a big deal for an American president to be the guest of honor, and so the Indians were pleased. The White House was pleased, and it. It was a useful thing. I'm sure the Pakistanis were fuming, but that's a whole different different issue. But I think the president was able to strengthen the ties between India, the world's largest democracy, and I think that was useful.
Well, Abdi, what about that? You know, I saw a list of all the things that they agreed on. There was no big thing, but there were certainly a lot of little things.
Well, there are also many of those big things are really big.
I mean,
India is obviously a way to, provides a way for the Obama administration to keep China in check. This is obviously, India is a serious competitor to China in that part of the world. It also helps the Obama administration get a better handle on Afghanistan now that the U.S. military and NATO have ended their mission in that country. Pakistan will continue to play a big role in Afghanistan, but we know this sort of love-hate relationship between the Pakistanis and the United States in Afghanistan. So India gives the Obama administration and the president of the United States beyond a much better handle on that part of the world as well. So for Obama, it's all win-win. Mind you, he had to cut his visit to India short and go to Saudi Arabia when the king of Saudi Arabia died.
Why did he have to do that?
Well, first of all, I don't think the Indians were miffed by that. I'm sure they perfectly understand how important it is for Obama to go to Saudi Arabia. I'm sure they understand how important Saudi Arabia is to the United States, not just in terms of oil, but also in terms of the regional politics, given everything that's happening in Iraq, in Syria, in Egypt, and beyond. So it was critical that Obama administration attend the funeral of King Abdullah.
I don't mean to criticize the American press. I'm a member of it. So, but Tom, the American press made such a big deal out of Michelle Obama's refusal to wear a headscarf when she was in Saudi Arabia. Maybe Abdi knows better than you or I do, but it didn't seem to me to be as big a deal as the press made it out in the United States.
Well, I don't think it was that big a deal, and I'm told the Saudis were not offended by it at all. It is a very male-dominated culture, to be sure. I don't think they were upset about that. I actually heard some reporters wondering whether President Obama was chewing gum while meeting the new King Salman, because he had been seen chewing gum with Prime Minister Modi. Talk about things that are ridiculous to deal with. But he had to go, and one of the reasons he had to go is because the Saudis have been shaken by American foreign policy. I think the Saudis were especially shaken by President Obama drawing what he called a red line against Syrian aggression against its own people, and then threatening consequences, and then not following up on that. There's been a lot of complaining by the royal family to many members of Congress, to many former secretaries of state and national security advisors and Middle East experts about the administration's policy. So they had to go. And I think the Obama administration did a smart thing. They included in the official delegation as many former secretaries of defense and former national security advisors as they could find who could make the trip. People like James Baker, who was George H.W. Bush's secretary of state, Condoleezza Rice, who was George W. Bush's secretary of state, Brent Scowcroft, who was a national security advisor to two presidents, President Ford and President George H.W. Bush. And the Saudis, having talked with somebody who actually was in that delegation, the U.S. government believes that the Saudis understood that. They got the message. Whether that is enough to allay some of the fears of the Saudi government remains to be seen. We'll have to see how the succession shakes out, but it was important to remind the Saudis just how important the relationship is with them and the U.S. government.
Well, I think that's all the time we have. Joining us today were Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to National Journal, and Abdurrahim Fukara, Washington Bureau Chief of Al Jazeera Satellite TV. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Thank you for listening.
From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Issues in the News. You can email your questions or comments to our panelists. Send them to voanews@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune in the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us next week at this time for Issues in the News.